This is Unconcluded, a real-time investigative podcast looking into the 2006 disappearance of Jennifer Kessie in Orlando, Florida. This is our second sidebar episode. It's our chance to respond to questions and comments and talk about other things that just don't fit into a regular episode. I'm your host, Sean Gerd.
And I'm your co-host, Scott Jay.
So we know that there was a lot of feedback and questions and comments about episode 4 and Lisa's story. And we're going to get to that. In fact, we'll devote a good portion of the show to discussing a lot of the questions and comments that you guys have about Lisa's story. But before we get there, there's a couple other things that I want to make sure that I talk about. We have a voicemail to respond to that deals with something that came up a little bit earlier in our investigation. And then the second thing I want to talk about is some questions that have been asked for a really long time. If you look at some of the other places on the internet that have been discussing this case for basically a decade, you'll see there's a common theme amongst a lot of the questions that are asked. And there are two of them in particular that I want to respond to on this show. So we'll do that first, and then we'll get into some discussion about Lisa.
All right, we're going to go ahead and get this started now with a voicemail from Krista.
Hi, my name is Krista. I live in Birmingham, Alabama, and I'm a fan of the podcast and appreciate your work that you're doing. I just had a question. I wondered about DNA evidence or fingerprints that were in Jennifer's car right after it was found at the apartment complex. Just wondering if that was tested, if there were any matches. And also wondering if that could be retested now since it's been so much time has passed. I just wondered if that was something they could, retest or put it through the system to see if there were any new matches. I enjoyed the podcast. Thanks so much. Bye.
This is actually one of the few answers that we can get directly from the detectives that are working Jennifer's case. If you remember, over the course of the first few episodes, we occasionally played some audio from Drew Kessie, Jennifer's dad. And that audio was taken from the 10-year anniversary press conference that her parents had with the Orlando police. Now, most of the audio that we've played has been from Drew, but the police chief and the detectives also spoke. The lead detective on the case, Detective Sprague, mentioned this specific evidence directly. So I'm going to go ahead and play her audio for you.
As Mr. Kessie indicated, DNA technology is ever-evolving. The kits they use are ever-evolving. The amount of DNA you need is ever-evolving. So a lot of the testing that's been done can be redone with these new kits. So most of it's, we're concentrating on Jennifer's vehicle. We think the answers probably lie there. So some of the things that they have tested and not been successful with, we want to resubmit to them based on evolving technology.
So basically what you've heard there is that the Orlando police did go ahead and retest the things that they were able to pull from her car. Now, it wasn't much. It's my understanding that they had one latent print and a fiber, and that's pretty much it. But according to Detective Sprague, they did go ahead and retest that. But because we haven't heard anything from that, I think at this point we have to assume that not much came of that retest, or at least obviously nothing that they're willing to share with us. So I appreciate the question because certainly it was a good one, even though it appears that really not much came of it.
Okay, now another question from Facebook, this one from Vivian. Joyce has stated when they arrived at Jennifer's condo that it was quote-unquote made clean. Did Logan and his friends clean the condo up before they left? Did they hire someone to come in and clean Jennifer's condo?
This is one of those questions that I was talking about earlier that I've seen asked for in different places that this case is discussed for a really, really long time. A lot of people like to point to this particular fact, if you will, that's been shared by Jennifer's family of a possibility for Jennifer's condo having been staged, meaning that the person who abducted her then cleaned her apartment, and that's why it was so clean. So people have been asking for quite a while exactly what that meant by made clean. And they've even theorized that maybe Logan and his friends had hired somebody to clean it after they had stayed there that weekend. So I wanted to ask Joyce directly what she had meant by made clean and if that was something that would have been abnormal.
You said it looked like a maid had cleaned it? Oh, yeah, her car. Yeah. No, Jennifer kept her home immaculate.
Okay, so she kept it like that all the time.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Okay.
So I think we can lay to rest the idea that Jennifer's condo was only clean because it was staged. Because according to Joyce, that's how it always was.
Okay, next up, another good question from Vivian from the Facebook discussion group. Was Jennifer's security alarm set when the Mosaic managers made their wellness check at the Kessie's request? Did Jennifer habitually set her security alarm?
This is another question that's been asked for basically a decade, with no answers, until now.
No, she didn't have the alarm code. It did have an alarm system, but Jennifer didn't have the alarm code. One of the things that people don't realize is that in her condo complex, where on the wall that you would put your bed, there was an emergency like call bell. So like if something happened in the middle of the night, you could, you know, pull the cord and it would activate to 911 and the police would come out. That was never pulled. So obviously, you know, whatever happened to Jennifer, our family and our closest friends and what have you, we all feel that whatever happened to Jennifer happened on Tuesday morning. None of us feel that it happened on Monday night.
That was Joyce again. And now that we have this information, it just seems really unlikely that anything happened inside of her apartment. We can't rule it out 100%, but the fact that she had a call bell to ring in case of emergency, and she never rang it, and also all the theories about the fact that the alarm was turned off, meaning that someone else had entered her apartment, there was an alarm in her condo, but it wasn't activated.
All right, so let's go ahead and move into the discussion about episode 4 and Lisa, who believes she saw Jennifer in a Tennessee jewelry store. We received a lot of feedback and questions about this one on social media and especially on the Facebook discussion group. Sean, a lot of people are having issues with Lisa's story and the amount of detail she's able to remember from something that happened over 10 years ago. I know you've talked to her about some of these questions, so what can you fill us in on?
You're right. We've received a ton of feedback about Lisa's story from episode 4. Some of you believe her story, and some of you don't at all. And this is pretty much what we expected. But it's one of those things that we had to consider as a possibility, even if it seemed unrealistic. Someone mentioned to us on Facebook that they were disappointed that the episode was devoted to this story, that they think we'd gotten sidetracked. Now, I responded on Facebook, but I also want to respond in general because I totally understand this comment. But what I told this person is, first, I don't consider this my podcast. It's all of ours. It's all of us together who can spread the awareness about Jennifer Kessie, and it's all of us together that have to work to figure out what else is out there. That means that every one of you needs the whole story as we go. What good does it do for us to sit on things? Now, that said, we're going to verify things to the best of our ability, and if it isn't credible, that's different. Do I think it's Jennifer that Lisa saw in Tennessee? To be honest, I probably don't. However, that doesn't mean it wasn't Jennifer, and it doesn't mean that I have the right to disregard it. There is absolutely no proof, other than Lisa's word, that the person in Tennessee was Jennifer, but at the same time, there isn't any proof that it wasn't. And that's the possibility that makes it worth sharing. Now, the good thing about what we're doing is I don't have to squeeze this investigation into an hour or into an episode or even 10 episodes. We have as long as it takes. And if that means taking an episode to explore something that could lead somewhere, however small the chance, we have to do it. If we explore 1,000 leads and 999 of them go nowhere, that's fine because one of them did. And at the end of it all, that's what this case needs, that one single thing that changes everything. Now, after the episode aired, as Scott mentioned, I've continued to talk to Lisa a bit, mostly about the questions and comments from all of you. If you're a member of our Facebook discussion group, I'm sure you saw the many threads with hundreds of posts delving into the story. So let's go ahead and clarify about why she was so detailed, because there's been people on both sides of that fence. Simply put, Lisa tells me that she's been trained to remember these things. She told me that she's been involved with her work in the jewelry business, a major robbery, which ended up becoming a federal case because it was connected to the 9/11 terrorist attacks. Because of those events, and her husband, who's a career federal law enforcement officer, she's been taught how to look for and remember things. She's been told what things to commit to memory, about how a person looks, and what they wear, and how they behave. She says that she never forgot it because of how deeply it affected her in the weeks and months and years after the event, as she researched and looked into human trafficking and similar crimes. She was unaware of them at the time of the event, but as she began to learn and become aware of them, she realized how important it was to remember the situation.
Okay, next up we have a question from Tara on Twitter. She says, listening to Unconcluded Pod, and if Lisa is telling the truth, why didn't she call the cops or set off the silent alarm?
Right after I talked to Lisa the first time, she wrote me an email to explain how upset she was that she hadn't called the police a decade ago when the event happened. She explained that as it had happened, she didn't know what to do. She was shaken by the event. But as I said in the last question, she didn't even know about human trafficking until after this happened. She had never witnessed someone being held against their will. And that's why she ended up being so compelled to put up posters in the store after the fact, once she realized what she may have seen. She also believed that they were long gone as soon as they had drove away. And it's also worth noting that the police force in this small town is maybe 2 or 3 officers, in total, whom her husband had said likely had no or little training in these kinds of situations. I think all of this kind of added up to the fact that she didn't feel like calling the police would have made a difference back then. She feels differently now. But that's not an excuse, and Lisa's made it clear to me she's not making excuses. She now realizes she should have called the police. But those were the things that were running through her head when the event occurred. She's now since contacted the police, the crime line, 3 times, but all of them have gone unanswered. She's also taken it upon herself to contact newspapers and radio stations in Tennessee. So, while she's very sorry that she didn't contact the police back then, she's no longer taking a passive role.
All right, as a follow-up to episode 4, Nicole on Facebook, as well as a lot of other people on the Facebook discussion group and on Twitter, were wanting to know if the jewelry store had video cameras set up and if they were able to access the footage from the day that Lisa was talking about.
Simply, the answer here is no. Unfortunately, I can't get into a lot of detail, but at the time of this event, it's my understanding that the video wouldn't have been available. And also, as many of you mentioned, it's probably unrealistic to expect that it still would have been there 11 years later. Most of these types of camera systems roll over the tapes after a set period of time, be it a week or a month or whatever. So to answer the question, is there video? Unfortunately, the answer is no.
Okay, here's a question from Donna on Twitter. Brilliant episode. Opens up questions for me. Especially, did anyone else in the jewelry store come forward and confirm the sighting?
As I mentioned in episode 4, I contacted the owners of the store that Lisa worked to confirm her story and her employment and all of those things. They didn't have a strong recollection of the event like Lisa, but they did remember it faintly. It's also worth mentioning that the owners of this store are, I think, in their late 70s or early 80s. So you can take that for what it's worth. They did make a point to tell me that Lisa was one of the smartest people they'd ever met in their lives, and that she has an incredible memory. And if she said something, I should believe it.
Okay, wrapping up our thoughts here on the jewelry store incident, Vincent had an interesting comment on the Facebook page. He says, I can't for the life of me understand how the details of the encounter were so vivid, but the actual month slash year eluded her memory. And of course, Sean, you've talked to Lisa numerous times, and I wanted to get what her thoughts on this were.
Well, we've already sort of mentioned about her memory, but I don't think that we mentioned that Lisa took notes. She wrote everything down that happened, and she wrote it all out. She told me that she talked to her husband and others that she'd shared the story with to help her confirm her memories, and she wrote out the entire event in detail before she called the crime line. So, if you want to know why her story was so long and so detailed, that's why. She had it right there in front of her as she was talking to me on the phone. Why is the date unclear? Well, she didn't write it down until years after it had happened.
Okay, Sean, some more feedback that we've been getting on episode 4 is that there are some people out there that don't believe that Jennifer fits the profile of a human trafficking victim. What are your thoughts on that?
I actually agree with a lot of you out there that hold this opinion. However, we've heard Jennifer's parents say that they believe it's a strong possibility. Quite simply, I don't think I can provide a good answer here. So I'm not going to. Instead, we're going to bring you a bonus episode this week, before we even get to episode 5, with an expert who can actually answer these questions with authority. So look for that later this week.
All right, well, that's all the time that we have for the question and answers this week. We really appreciate everybody that is submitting questions via social media and the voicemail line. We will try to get to as many more as we can next week. Make sure you keep getting those questions in.
Now, before we go today, there's a couple other things I wanted to get to. First, I want to make sure that everyone knows we aren't putting all of our eggs into one basket. We haven't taken Lisa's story and decided to run with it. It's just one of many different leads we're following up on. So while we may have shared that particular story on our last episode, that's not the only thing that we're working on. As you heard me mention earlier, we're going to be back with a bonus episode this week. I had a chance to talk to someone who is an expert in the area of human trafficking, and they're going to share some insight about this case, and they're going to share some insight that they have into that world. We'll be back with our regular episode next Sunday. Also, before we go, I want to make sure I give a huge shout out and thank you to Karen and to Christy. They've become our first patrons on Patreon.com, which we've just set up. If that's something that you might be interested in, you can visit unconcluded.com and click support. Lastly, on our Facebook page, people are always asking what other podcasts are out there that they can listen to. So we thought it might be interesting to share some other podcasts with you on our sidebar episodes. So this week, we want to introduce you to a show called True Crime Fan Club. Here's the host, Lainey.
Hey guys, it's Lainey, host of the True Crime Fan Club podcast. If you're a true crime addict like I am, then my podcast is for you. It's a podcast for the ultimate true crime enthusiast, giving you a glimpse into the life and crimes of the most demented minds. You won't want to miss an episode.
So be sure to check that out. And remember, we'll have a bonus episode this week and be back with our regularly scheduled episode on Sunday.